Arthur Phillips has done what few have dared. He's written a play by Shakespeare, a play meant to re-inhabit the rich language of the bard. It's the backdrop for his new novel called The Tragedy of Arthur, a work of meta-fiction about a man named Arthur, whose family uncovers a lost Shakespeare play. The main character is an alter ego for his creator. Both are named Arthur Phillips. But beyond that, Phillips' novel goes one step further. It includes the entire lost Shakespeare play, the novel's linchpin, as written by a Brooklyn novelist named Arthur, of course. If it all sounds a bit complicated, well, it is. So let's just listen to Phillips reading from the book's beginning.
My twin sister Dana and I were obviously not identical twins, but as the family phrase had it, we were something more than fraternal. Our resemblance was not magical enough, not nearly, to fool anyone, to engage in Disney-ish trickery against parents or teachers, not even enough of a vocal similarity before puberty to lure telephone Romeos into embarrassment. Still, 38 or 39 minutes her junior, I found her waiting for me in Abbott Northwestern Hospital's delivery room. And if I depict her as waiting impatiently for me to emerge from our mother as the clock swung past midnight on April 22nd, I don't think it's really too fanciful. Shakespeare's work is teeming with twins, perfectly identical twins who don't know of each other's existence, fraternal twins identically lovable despite different genders, separated twins in the employ of other separated twins, and it was through twins, Twelfth Night and The Comedy of Errors, that Dana first swooned for Shakespeare. There she is on my dad's lap, the fat collected works open on her own lap, both of them laughing about some Dromio or other, cheek to cheek, assigning each other parts, while I arranged blue plastic knights on the floor.
Thank you. Tell us a little bit more about the book, if you would. What happens?
The book purports to be the first publication in more than 400 years, of a Shakespeare play, which has been lost and then recently rediscovered. The play is included in the back of the book, and with it comes a long introduction explaining how it is that it's been lost for 400 years and then recently rediscovered, and how it is that the person who's recently rediscovered it and is writing the introduction happens to be me, and how it is that I'm the only person on Earth who owns a copy of a long-lost Shakespeare play. And so I take the opportunity to introduce the play, to discuss its history, and also to discuss how my family history is quite crucial to understand the nature of the play and whether the play is what it claims to be on its cover page.
You have to have been some kind of a Shakespearean scholar in order to feel comfortable creating a Shakespearean play.
That's a wonderful idea, but no, I didn't have to be. It turns out what I had to be was a somewhat impertinent novelist who thought, I wonder if I could do this, and if I could do it, what would I have to learn ahead of time, and what would be fun to do, and maybe more to the point, what would it take to feel like I was a little bit inside his skin and a little bit inside his language and a little bit inside the world that he lived in, even though I live in Brooklyn, which is not the most Elizabethan part of the country. And so I'm not a Shakespearean scholar, but I am a pretty good mimic, and I'm very interested in trying to sort out what it felt like to live at a certain time, and especially when I come upon someone whose life I admire. And from what little we do know of Shakespeare's life, I'm very interested in him as a man and as a writer.
I actually would be interested in answers to some of the questions that you just raised, the ones you proposed to yourself before beginning to write that. You looked at his plays and decided, what would I have to know in order to be able to mimic that?
Well, yeah. So some of it's very logical kind of research. First thing I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to read all these plays. I'm going to read them in the order, possible order, that we think he wrote them, so I get a sense of how his style develops over time. I'm going to read them out loud so that I can hear how the words fit together and the rhythms of them and how those rhythms change over time. You know, to take as an example, we know about Shakespeare that he tended to write in what's called blank verse, which is non-rhyming but rhythmic lines of poetry, each line usually 10 syllables long. And we know that early in his career, the end of a line is where the end of a sentence usually happens, so that his ideas were finishing within the sort of logical framework of his poetry, if that makes sense. As he got older and he got more experienced and he got more skilled at what he was doing, those sentences could end in the middle of a line. They could end between two speakers splitting up the same line. It got a lot more flexible and a lot less stiff sounding as a result. That's something that scholars knew about. That's something that I sort of discovered by reading all of his stuff out loud. What else did I do to research? I read about his life, what we do know about him. I read about the verse and how it's put together. I read about his source material, which interested me a great deal. What did he read before he wrote? What sort of research was he doing? There's a history book, a sort of potted history book called Hollinshed's Chronicles. And we know that he read at least some of it because some of it is transposed practically word for word into his history plays. So I read some of that. And I tried to get a sense of how did he take that history material and change it? Where did he follow it verbatim? Where did he mess up the chronology for dramatic effect? Where did he add new characters completely out of his own imagination? And why? What sort of things might have been inspiring him to go off the page there and come up with something new?
Because you were also creating a story in which there would be questions about the very play that you are about to write, you must have also done a fair amount of research into those who have said there was no Shakespeare, or that Shakespeare didn't write those plays.
You know, I was very much moved by Jim Shapiro's book, Contested Will, which is about the sources of anti-Stratfordian thinking. And he pointed out, I think, a very good point, which is the real underlying cause of Shakespeare denial is exaggerated Shakespeare love. That when you got to the point 150, 200 years after his death, in which people are talking about Shakespeare as a god-like figure, a deity of writing, someone so far beyond other humans and other writers that he must have been some kind of Superman. Well, it's nonsense. And then when that nonsense comes up against otherwise rational people, they say to themselves, well, hold on a second. If this is true, if somebody that amazing wrote these plays, if the things that are so important to us are important to us because they were written by a Superman, I've got to find out who that Superman was, because it couldn't possibly have been that kid from Stratford. It must have been a nobleman. It must have been a philosopher. It must have been the Queen of England. And so we try to find some super figure historically who can fill the impossibly ludicrous shoes that were imagined as well. So to answer your question, the character in my book starts with saying, I don't buy into the Shakespeare love in the first place. It's overdone and it's overwrought and it blinds us to what he may or may not have been, all of which I agree with. The character in the book goes a little farther than that, but I happen to agree with that. He was a writer, and he was a writer among writers. So you don't have to find a Superman either in him or in anybody else. You can just find a writer.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it? Because Shakespeare is universally agreed to be one of the greatest writers, if not the greatest writer of the English language ever, which is a pretty high standard to live up to, both for him and then for you trying to create even an early edition of Shakespeare. A lot of people would simply say, I'm not walking into that arena.
Well, yeah, I guess that would be the healthy response. Well, first of all, you know, the description you just gave of him, universally accepted to be the greatest writer of all time, I take exception to it. And so it was easier to walk into that arena having taken exception to it. And I think about him at the time that he lived, and I am very interested in his world. But nobody at the time talked about him like that. Nobody talked about him like that for 200 years afterwards. He was one of many writers, and for some people, he was the best of the time, and people really thought he was the top. But for other people, they weren't that into him. And some people described him as wonderfully prolific. That's all, just prolific. And some people said, you know, he's really, really good at tragedy. He's as good as Thomas Watson, to which everyone should say, who? Because we don't have any Thomas Watson. It's all lost. Every last word of Thomas Watson is lost. And yet, he was a guy who at the time people said, yeah, Shakespeare's almost as good as Watson. So the casual acceptance over the centuries now that he is somehow of another world, of another species than the rest of the writers of his time or of our time or of any time is really, I take to be quite wrong and quite undermining of his ability to still impress us. Or to impress me, anyhow. I guess I can only speak for myself. I really learned to love him after I had disabused myself of the notion that he could only be loved.
I thought actually one of the reasons that he may be so described, universally believed to be the best writer in the English language, is because once you've put him there and admitted that you're never going to be the best writer of English
right.
ever,
right.
That gives you an example of writing that you don't have to try to match. You can do whatever you want as long as you don't pretend to be Shakespeare.
That's a great insight, because I think much about becoming a writer, becoming a novelist, is shaking yourself loose of the idea that you have to be as good as anybody else. And yes, the ultimate example of that is Shakespeare. He is the one who is held up, for better or worse, as the unmatchable super god. And so you're right, tiptoeing into that arena and saying, well, hold on a second, let's see if I can't pull one of these off, is somewhat a statement of I don't know what it's a statement of, being a jackass,
hubris?
I guess. Hubris, being a jackass, whatever. But also just having fun and feeling like I'm going to get to know him better. Even if I fail, I'm going to get to know him better. And the standard I set myself actually wasn't impossible, because I set myself a technical standard. Use his words, use his structures, use his forms and his formulas, use his themes and his types of characters, use his source material. All of that stuff can be done, if you're careful, quote-unquote, correctly. What doesn't happen, of course, is whether or not someone reads it and goes, wow, that feels like Shakespeare. And some people have read it and said, wow, that feels like Shakespeare. And others have read it and said, that feels like a parody, or that doesn't feel anything like Shakespeare, or that was a hubristic and ridiculous thing to try to do and you should stop it now. So I've gotten a whole range of responses, and I think that has very much to do with the reader as well. Yeah. If you go in thinking, you can't do that, that's not possible, then you'll read it and you'll say, yeah, he didn't do it, it isn't possible. But if you go in saying, well, maybe, let's see how it goes, I think that you can have moments in which you say, well, hold on, I know this isn't Shakespeare, and yet at least this passage really feels convincingly like him. So what is the thing that we call Shakespearean? What does that mean for a writer to have a particularly recognizable identity on the page?
So, curious about the newly minted Shakespeare play by Arthur Phillips? Here's a taste. Read by actor William Bowles as King Arthur before the war.
Now thick-walled York looms gray and cold above, and bristles all along like porpentine with spear and bolts that sent out English flesh. My English friends, my English brothers now, you hear my voice's maiden call to arms, to urge you on who want from me no urging, and quicken ire of knights to martial wrath who were born fighting men ere I was born, to lead you where you have already bled, but I have not. What king is this who calls? And York should be the first and last of me. Let no man say I was not Uther's son, nor valued more than he this bubble life. But of our foemen this cannot be said. Who waits for us within, fell Englishmen? This Saxon pride set sail o'er Humber's tide, and then conjoined to Pictish treachery for but to cower, spent and quaking shy, portcullised fast behind the walls of York, as guilty lads will seek their mother's skirts when older boys they vex come for revenge. But Arthur's at the gate. 'Tis Britain's fist that hammers now upon the shivering boards. An English blood be thin as watery wine, then sheathe we now our swords and skulk away, with Saxon language tripping from our lips. You'd con the invader's tongue? Absit omen! Let's school them then in terms of English arms, decline and conjugate hard words. But hark! She sighs with gentle pleading that we come. Now wait no more to save her, nobles in, and pull those Saxon arms off English skin!
Actor William Bowles with a reading from the novel The Tragedy of Arthur by Arthur Phillips.